Well, last time we didn't get to four, so I want to talk about the two psukim in four that I had picked out, namely chapter 4, verse 4, and then chapter 4, verse 7, and then go on from there. So in chapter 4, verse 4, it says, "Kimigdal David Savarech," that your neck is like the Tower of David, "Banui l'talpiot," it is built in a tower way, "Elef hamagain talui alav," there are 1,000 shields that are hanging on it, "Kol shilte giborim," all of the shields of mighty men. A very, strange verse, obviously. So on page 12, here are some of the commentaries about it. So Rashi writes, I have them consecutively numbered, so Rashi writes already in the second line, "Savarech zu lishkat hagazit." That's quite a stretch. Saying that it's talking about the chamber of hewn stone. There were a number of rooms in the Beit HaMikdash, and the Lishkat HaGazit was the room that the Sanhedrin sat in. Shaita ha-chazkan u-mivtzaran shel Yisrael. That the Sanhedrin, which adjudicated laws, that was considered the strength and the fortress of Am Yisrael. So therefore, this Migdal, there's all this stuff about the neck, that it is very important as far as the person is concerned. I mean, everything is important, I suppose. But here we're talking about it gives structure, it gives strength to the form, to the overall Am Yisrael. Yoto Migdal banui l'talpiot, banui l'noi, liyot hakol mistaklimbo. So it is specifically constructed in such a way that people will be attracted to admire it. Vinoy melechet tavnito. So the way that it is made, it is supposed to be decorous or something that will be attractive, which is interesting in terms of the law. In other words, you don't necessarily think of a court as an aesthetic experience, or that the law is something that should be considered beautiful necessarily. On the other hand, if it's not, if it's something that's repulsive, that's not going to attract people to be part of it. So there's a whole issue of style. In other words, the way a person conducts himself, the way, I remember many years ago, one of my friends was saying about someone else that they wear their religion very beautifully. No, not on the sleeve. On the sleeve is already, I know, that's pejorative. And they were... right, so outwardly, but inwardly there's something else. Mm-hmm. He was saying that this person was an integrated personality. In other words, that in fact there was an aesthetic about their... I mean, certain people carry themselves and act in a certain way that's attractive, and there are other people who don't. Whether they can help it or not is, part of the issue. Some people are simply not socially attuned, or people are, they have certain issues. But it could also be whether you're paying attention, whether, in fact, this is a value. Now, simply to be involved in the aesthetics sacrificing everything else, that would be a problem. But it's part of the deal. The Vilna Gaon said, "Sheker achein vehevel hayofi shat yirat Hashem." There's nothing wrong with chein and yofi as long as there's yirat Hashem. I mean, if there's only chein and yofi and there's no yirat Hashem, so then that's a problem. But there is nothing wrong with having this kind of combination. And so here, with regard to Sanhedrin, it's just an interesting juxtaposition, it seems to me. I mean, Shir HaShirim, many of these verses are talking about the attractiveness of one person to the other. And here we're saying that it can be applied to law. It can be applied to the way a court is run, it could be applied to the way Dayanim hold themselves, and also it can be applied to the way that they deal with things. And so much of the controversies that we're seeing with the Rabbanut HaRoshit, we could say that it's not l'talpiot. In other words, that they're not really concerned with it being attractive or something that will be, palatable. They're interested in their view of what the law requires, or perhaps their political considerations or whatever. And so there is a disconnect with regard to that. Ibn Ezra similarly says, "Domelo lishkat hagazit," it's talking, Ibn Ezra is, I'm sorry, this is the Rashi continuing, in the next Dibur HaMatchil, on the second line, it's on Shilte, so it's on the first line. Domel Lushkara Gazit, Shemisham Horah Yotzei Sheh Torah Magen LiYisrael. So again, this idea of the shields of the Giborim. So that, I think, is an easier connect to the idea of talking about law. And there is certainly law gives structure and protection to the institutions of the society, but to say that law should also be something attractive, that's interesting, I think. And Kol Shulte Giborim, Rashi says, Matzinu Shatalmidim Nikraim Al Shem Chitzim L'Shalitim. That students, here we're talking about students of the Torah, they talk in terms of arrows and of shields. There's a famous Rashi with regard to Yaakov when he's talking to Yosef, and he's telling him how he acquired Shechem with his sword. And everyone says, well, we don't see any record of that. So there's one view that says, yes, there was a counterattack after the commando raid of Shimon and Levi and the rest of the brothers on Shechem. There was a counterattack, and Yaakov single-handedly fended them off. Okay, maybe not. Another view is that the weapons of a Talmid Chacham are his prayers and his good deeds. So in fact, you can have a different kind of transference where you're looking at what a person does, and even though he seems rather passive or he's not terribly aggressive. However, and I mean, this is the argument of the Haredim not going into the army. They're saying, well, they're also protecting the Jewish people. They're just protecting them metaphysically. I mean, you have to believe in that, and you're not ducking any bullets, although maybe you're ducking the Yetzer Hara, or you're ducking, metaphysical threats. And, I'm not going to weigh in on that. But that's part of the issue. And there's, can you be a defender of the faith and the people, so to speak, by engaging in spiritual pursuits? Or is that, just escaping responsibility, and the people who actually risk themselves in a very tangible fashion, they're the ones who get more credit for doing that. Anyway, so that's Rashi's take on this. Rashi, he doesn't take anything literally, it seems. He's only looking at this from the point of view of what can we see this symbolize or represent. We said the Malbim, he has this ongoing metaphor about the soul yearning to be reunited with its source. And so this is no exception. So the Malbim writes over here, Kimigdal, achar sheta'aret ha-nefesh kamo she'i po'elet bi'atzma ba'sagat ha-seichel v'chachma, the nefesh on its own tries to develop its intellect and its wisdom, matchil etzayra kafi shehi manheget et hagvi'a umoshelet olav. Then what is the interaction of the soul with the body? Well, the soul tries to get the upper hand, as the body does as well. There is this milchemet hayetzer, if you like, this war that supposedly goes on. V'yoreid min asfor ta'arei hagalgelet shu mishkan lenefesh hamaskelet. So the nefesh resides in the mind, and resides in the head, but in order to get at the body, it's got to go down the neck. In other words, that's the connector. El emtsa'it hagvi'a shesham mishkan hanefesh achiyunit. The body holds this life force, which is sometimes counter to the spiritual force. And there's the two things sort of working out.
The lathe, though, had something to...
Sometimes, but the Malbim, he's much more scientific and naturalistic scientific that way. And so therefore, he wants to have the brain versus the body. But you're right. I mean, in symbolic terms, having a good heart, the heart also is spiritual, but that's not the way the Malbim sees it. V'nei atzavar hu aparochet hamavdil bein hagalgelet v'agvi'a. Interesting metaphor. The neck is the parochet, is the separating curtain, if you like, between the brain and the rest of the body. U'ki'ilu derech hamesech hazeh shu atzavar, by means of this separation, which is the neck, titein hanefesh kola. That's how the soul can give its voice. Kol oz letzavot limshol al hanefesh achiyunit v'kochotea. I mean, if you take, neurological ideas, etc., yes, there are decisions made in the brain, and therefore those decisions have to be communicated to the rest of the body. And I guess the neck is a connector, right? So in other words, on the spinal cord, you've got all these neurons and stuff like go up and down. And so you can even take this in a physiological point of view. But he's, I think, looking at it much more in a metaphysical way. Asher haya banui l'talpuyot v'sham amdu agiborim noshkei romei keshet l'lchom et ha'ayvim b'sha'ar. The body, it's not the brain that usually fights off the enemies, it's the body that fights off the enemies, but there has to be some kind of communication between the brain and the body. V'alav haya talui elef ha'magein l'chol shilte giborim l'krav u'milchama. So when it comes to warfare, it's not like the brain disconnects and the body just does what it does, but rather there has to be some kind of coordination. Anyway, so you have this, the brain or the mind has to take these various roles with regard to all of this kind of stuff. It sort of reminds me, there's a Gemara which talks about how, when someone did a sin, so therefore the brain says, well, without the body, I couldn't have done anything, so you can't blame me. And the body said, without the brain, I couldn't have done anything, so you can't blame me. So God puts them together, and he says, no, I'll blame all of you. I'll blame the combination. And so that's a certain kind of attitude. Does the Milchemet HaYetzer mean that I can dichotomize a person into pieces? I suppose when you have a truly bipolar or schizophrenic person, that's what happens, that the person is bisected into different modes, and therefore one doesn't necessarily communicate with the other, or one isn't answerable to the other, and that's obviously an illness. That's not something that's normal. Normally speaking, there is this kind of ongoing interchange between between the two, and it also, it seemed to me, I made a note here that but the nefesh has to have a sense of itself. Let's say that, I think there's some people whose nefesh doesn't seem to be terribly developed. They're just body. They're just gut and just instinct. And that's a problem as well. To have just a cerebral person who is not of this world, that's problematic. And to have a person who is only animalistic or physical, we consider that a problem as well. And so therefore there's got to be this sort of combination. The thing I wrote today, it hasn't been published yet, but it will be, I hope so. In Ha'azinu, Rabbi Steinsaltz wants to claim that he asked the question, why is it that in Ha'azinu it's really so negative? In other words, that Moshe says, you're going to be terrible. It's going to be really bad. Maybe eventually you'll straighten out, but it's going to be bad. Whereas in the rest of Devarim and also in other places, there's a choice. Okay, you've got life, you've got death. If you listen, fine. If you don't, no. So in other words, it's not inevitable. And here it says it's inevitable. And he wants to argue that everyone has a tendency towards normalization. Everyone wants to be like everyone else. You see that with kings, I wrote, because they say, I want to be like all the other people. They got kings, I want a king. Or you have this business with Yaakov, that Rashi that always haunts me, where it says, Vayeshev Yaakov, Bikesh Yaakov, Leshev Bashalva, Yaakov wanted peace and quiet, Kofatz Alav, Rogzo Shel Yosef, and the whole issue of Yosef jumped on him. Amar Kodesh Baruch Hu, Dayan L'Tzadikim, Shemitukan Lohem Olam Haba, it's not enough for Tzadikim that they have the world to come, they want to sit Bashalva in this world too. That's what Shalva is, I put in parentheses, normalcy, calm, peace and quiet. So in that sense, you have there, according to Rabbi Steinsaltz, Torah and mitzvot are basically trying to make you abnormal. Or maybe abnormal has too much of a pejorative sense, but supernatural, if you like. Not normal. Not like the way everyone else does things. You're supposed to do things differently. You're supposed to march to a different drummer. That also has implications with regard to Zionism. In other words, that I mentioned many years ago, I read Hill Halkin's book, Letters to an American Jewish Friend, which I think is a great book. It's sort of like the Kuzari, where he makes up an imaginary friend who stayed in America, and he, meanwhile, resettled in Israel, and so they have a debate. And so I follow the argument, and it's very inspiring until he gets to the end. He says, listen, Nicaraguans have Nicaragua, so why can't we have a state? I said, that's it? We're basically looking to be a third world Central American country. That's the point. That seems to me to not be very I don't know, inspiring? You know, why not? No, obviously, if you want to be more than that, well, that takes harder work.
Is this a religious person?
No, he's secular. He's very well known. He's a public intellectual. He's written a lot. He's translated a lot.
What's his name?
Hillel Halkin. He went to Ramaz even. He writes about that in commentary. One day he forgot his tefillin accidentally on purpose on the subway, you know, that kind of thing. Anyway, no, it's very interesting guy. And the book is a very good book, I think. But, except at the end. It's sort of similar. There's a book by Herbert Weiner called Nine and a Half Mystics, which is a very good book. The Reform Rabbi, and he interviews all these interesting holy people. Babichi Rebbe's in there, Steinsaltzel's in there, I mean, all kinds of people. And then at the end, he says, yeah, but it's not for me. I said, come on. You know, you're inspired by these people. You think that these people are very neat and admirable. But no, you know, you keep it at arm's length. Why not follow through? You know, go the next step. I mean, that's... anyway. So that's the Malbim. And we'll look at one on page 13. Here's a Gemara where it says, "Kimigdal David Savar, Ze Beit HaMikdash." So he's not talking about the Sanhedrin, he's talking about the Beit HaMikdash in general. "V'lama minameu bet Savar," so why is the Beit HaMikdash compared to the neck? "Mat Savar Ze Natun Begav Ho Shel Adam," just like the neck is towards the height of the, you know, the top of the person. "Beit HaMikdash Natun Begav Ho Shel Olam." No, this is the Gemara. This is Shem's probably Midrash Rabbah. It's probably the Midrash on Shir HaShirim. So it's talking about how the Beit HaMikdash is at the top. Now, there can be literal and figurative when we talk about the top. Same thing as great. Like Rav Moshe Feinstein was a gadol. He was a really short little guy. So, but being a gadol doesn't necessarily mean how many feet and inches you are. So when I say that something's at the top of the world, so you say, well, Israel's supposed to, Aliyah, you go up, yeah, but Mount Everest, you know. No, that's not the point. The point is that it depends on what your frame of reference is as far as what is Begav O Shel Olam, that is, at the, you know, the top of the world. Umatzavar zeh rov tachshitin tluyin bo. So a person, when they wear jewelry, they suspend most of their jewelry from their neck. Kuhuna mi Beit HaMikdash, Luvia mi Beit HaMikdash. So the Kohanim Luvim are the jewels of the Beit HaMikdash. That's an interesting metaphor and analogy. And certainly the way they were dressed, well, Luvim were dressed fairly plainly. Kohanim also, except for the Kohen Gadol, who had quite impressive
jewelry.
Stuff. Anyway, Omatzav Arzeh, Im Notel Ein La Adam Chayim. And if you can't live without your neck, so Shachara Beit HaMikdash Ein Chayim L'Sonei Yisrael. Now Sonei Yisrael is a euphemism. When the Gemara or the Midrash says something really terrible about the Jews, it can't bring itself to say it. So it uses the term Sonei Yisrael, but it's not talking about the anti-Semites. It's talking about the Jews. But this is like, you know, poo poo poo. I don't want to say it. But the point seems to be that without the Beit HaMikdash, there is a certain dimension of life that is missing. Spiritual life, certainly. We seem to get along okay without the Beit HaMikdash, but you can imagine that experience was considered to be something very profound. And even though Beit Knesset and Beit HaMidrash are supposed to, you know, make up for that, I mean, Mikdash Ma'at, at least on a microcosmic level, it doesn't. They don't. I mean, it's just, I mean, I ended up davening in a yeshiva for the first time in 45 years yesterday. And it's quite moving, and it reminded me of a lot of things. It also wasn't a lot of things. But to say, I mean, but I could understand. And I also came to the conclusion about, you know, I always in many places, and I've said it also, I don't get why people just do these things once a year. You know, that this is important, it should be every day. But it wouldn't have the same power if it would be every day. Because not so much fasting, but praying with that, having that particular liturgy, it strikes you different. And if it were every day, routinization and normalcy will take away and we'll just get used to it. And sort of like the Hinni Muchon Mezuman, I need a preparation, and then I need a preparation for the preparation, and then I need a preparation for the preparation for the preparation. In other words, it all becomes tacit. The first few times, that's why for a kid it's so interesting, because it's all new. But for people who have been around the block, it's not new. So it becomes the person's task to try to keep it new, and that's not always so easy. That's really quite challenging. Anyway, the other pasuk that I wanted.
Say, Kadesh Yemeinu Kekedem.
Yes.
I wish it were like the older days.
Well, that's one way to look at it. Or it says, you must make your days like the olden days. Mm-hmm. In other words, the same excitement and enthusiasm mm-hmm. that you had in the olden days. I mean, it's easier said than done, obviously. But the same excitement, that should be my goal. I shouldn't say, okay, been there, done that. So what
no,
else
like
is
there's no real stuff. They just sing songs.
Well,
and the island likes because they know that
they're singing songs is an attempt to get into things. But I agree with you. I had this correspondence with this guy. Remember, I mentioned this. Did I bring it along? I mentioned that. Oh yeah, maybe not. I was talking to this Rosh Hashiva at YU, Ozer Glickman. So there was this wonderful. Here it is. So this is just what he wrote. Over the past few years, he's a Rosh Hashiva at YU and also a finance consultant. I mean, he does both things.
Make him living.
Yeah. Over the past few years, I've received emails, voicemails, PMs, and one or two old-fashioned letters from adults who heard me daven Musaf and Neila during their childhoods in West Orange, New Jersey. Many of them live now in Israel. They tell me that I am the voice in their heads when they think of Yamin Narayim. I mean, we all have that,
yes.
Right? That's not a bad thing to be, although it does make me an aging relic of time long past. Often, they will ask me to record a selection from the Masor with the traditional Nusach. I have never been a fan of replacing our majestic Ashkenazi Nusach with the NCSY hit parade we hear most Shabbatot during Kedusha and Chazar Sashat. Traditional Nusach and most traditional melodies melodically evoke the meaning and the context of the passage recited. Sometimes it's just ignorance. Singing Adam Yisodomi Afar, man whose basis is dust, to an upbeat, bouncy Avram Fried niggun grates on the ear and offends the knowledgeable davener. It should never
write the article.
It should never be about appealing to the lowest common denominator if we can appeal to everyone. Music has always been very evocative for me. Listening, playing, and singing music is an important part of my life. I remembered how much this past Tuesday on a coffee run in downtown Boston, we were discussing native musical ability, and I confessed to having perfect pitch. In the casual way that only a young person can ask an older colleague, she asked if it were true that perfect pitch is lost during the aging process. I thought not, but hurriedly rushed to the hotel when she went back to the office. I found the piano in the bar, which was deserted in the early afternoon hours. With no one around to object, I hummed what my ear told me was middle C, lifted the cover on the keyboard, held my breath, struck middle C a little more strongly than I intended, Baruch Hashem. We had a match. I'm still got it. Since no one was around and I had 90 minutes until my next meeting, this is a Rosh Hashiva, I sat down to play. I warmed up like I always do with Dave Brubeck's gymnastic Rondo a la Turk. But with thoughts of aging and the passage of time, I needed something more for the heart than the hands. I am, of course, very deeply Jewish and very Hebrew-oriented with everything from Kalir to Halevi to Shweki to the Gashash and Pugi. I don't even know who those are. But I'm also an American who hung around Columbia during the late 60s and 70s, who ran with the Bulls on Wall Street during the 80s and 90s, who lives a life of Torah Umada for what it's worth. The soundtrack of my life includes Clapton and Dylan, who just won the Nobel Prize, of all things, and The Doors and Chicago and Smokey. It was time to cry a little for my lost innocence, for the lost childhoods of the children who remember me as a young father for the years I will never regain. I played the opening chords to Clapton's hymn, Tears in Heaven, closed my teary eyes, and began to sing. After the first verse, I heard a clink of a glass and saw a smiling bartender leaving a glass on the piano for me to have a drink on the house. He smiled and gestured for me to go on. He has seen me there before, a man of a certain age in a business suit with a power tie and an arsenal cap. I watched him go back behind the bar to do something at the register, but quickly closed my eyes and went on. It was pretty predictable what would come next. A piano version of Richie Havens' cover of Just Like a Woman, one of my favorite poems ever. I sang a little more confidently now and closed my eyes to enjoy the freedom not to sit in an office over a keyboard or a phone all day. As I came to the end of Dylan's masterpiece, I heard a crinkle. Opening my eyes, I saw a woman slip a couple of rumpled dollar bills into the desk. I bowed to her and she smiled, walking from the bar. I will daven shacharit from the Amud this year using the nusach to which my father and grandfather thrilled, in which my son will sing in his shul on the other side of Teaneck when he does the same. I understand, though, the desperation to connect with others through music and why some are drawn to the familiar. Mm-hmm. On the way back to my client's office, I clutch those bills in my hand, then reluctantly put them in the cup of a street person on Summer Street. I mean, it's wonderfully written also. Yeah. But
what's the
writer's name? Ozer Glickman.
Wow. How old, like?
He's an older guy.
Older?
My age.
Really old. Oh, that's not old.
That's what she said.
Not old.
Thanks. Thanks. Anyway, I think that's very cool.
But you know, the songs of your childhood and the way you always remember it, because I still hear my parents' rabbi's voice in my head, no matter who's davening, right. I still hear it.
But the nusach is a real issue, and I think that because people don't have familiarity with nusach, and they do have familiarity with
pop songs,
and they'll do that. I mean, even at the yeshiva, some of the things were that, but not most of them. And I also appreciated the people who daven at the yeshiva are the Rosh Yeshiva. Mm-hmm. And so a Ben Torah who davens is different from a professional chazan, from a balabas who's not. Mm-hmm. Just different. And you hear that very, very profoundly.
They do even Kiddush on Shabbos, too, it's like Bruno Mars.
Yeah.
It takes away a little
because
for me, but Amy says this is how the young people get engaged.
It might be, but that's too bad. And I actually wrote to him, I said, so what do you think about Karlbach? Because I think some of the Karlbach does fit into the words. And he says, I think it's still slappy clappy. He doesn't feel that.
But sometimes, you know, it's like chazanus,
right.
Know, like where you're listening to someone perform.
Okay, well, I'm not interested in that either.
Yeah,
I don't think he is necessarily.
Right,
either.
No, I'm just saying that sometimes that's how
I agree. Well, that's why I said professional singers who I don't particularly appreciate, nor do I particularly appreciate people who don't have an idea of what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So,
I had a question about the neck.
Yeah.
Thing. Isn't there, this is really bothering me because I can't remember, but isn't there like a famous neck, like something in the Navi, where it compares nations, one's the neck? I don't know. Something.
I don't know. I'll look for it.
Does anyone, I remember like someone drawing a chart
okay.
with the neck, but I don't remember.
Well,
I think it's Navi.
I mean, there's all this stuff
sure.
about in the Kuzari, he mentions how the Jews are like the heart and all the other nations are the other kinds of the body. Body can't deal without the heart, but here it says the body can't deal with it. I mean, frankly,
well,
the body can't deal with
it. Your breath, your food.
Yeah.
But there are certain parts
right,
of your body
right.
that you do
right.
not need.
Correct.
Right.
There are things that are right.
Appendix.
Exactly.
Appendix.
Tonsils.
Spleen.
Okay. Right. Two kidneys. One kidney.
Pinky toe.
Meanwhile, it's not great. I mean, you know, a person is whole when they're whole, and if you have to give parts up or if something is sick, okay, but. It's not necessarily ideal, that's all. Anyway, so the other pasuk is on page 13, Perek Dalet Pasuk Zayin, where it says, Kulach yafa rayati umum einba.
It's in Daniel.
Daniel. Yeah.
The neck thing?
The neck thing.
Okay, I'll look
at it. Okay, thank you. How'd you remember? I'm impressed.
We took a class.
Yeah. did someone draw a chart?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I remember.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll look for it.
Very good.
remember, next week we're off, and
right,
and then the following week I think we're back.
Okay.
Anyway, so, Kulach yafar rayati yumum einbach. So it's, again, one of these verses that one person is saying how beautiful the other person is, how handsome, how attractive. So the Malbim on this, there isn't even any Rashi. Me'ata achar shegam nefesh achai vatzomeach hitachdu ela kodesh. That the soul of that which is living and that which is even a plant has united towards holiness. V'yishkon Hashem kavod b'tocham l'kabel mehem reach nichoach. So it sounds like he's talking about korbanot and the fact that sacrifices can be brought from animals and from plants and from various things. So this implies a certain kind of unity or certain kind of connection between all of these things, as long as it's dedicated to God. Me'ata ein mum b'yichida haraya bat maron. So there is no mum, there is no blemish, there's nothing that is inappropriate. Ki ad ata haya ba mum kavua mechubar ba shu nefesh hachai v'atzomeach shitchabru ima v'yudvukim ba sheroa v'kalut. Compared to the nefesh, it would seem that the body, which is sort of in the category of animals and plant life, etc., there is this split. On the one hand, you have this very ethereal aspect of a person, and then you have also more earthly aspects. Vayum avdilim beinam lebein hakodesh, and they would divide. Well, poslim oto miliot kohen lekel elyon. Being a kohen lekel elyon is not only being a kohen because your dad was a kohen. Mm-hmm. A kohen lekel elyon is the task of Bnei Yisrael. In other words, they're supposed to be the priest to God. They're supposed to be the Am Skula. They're supposed to be Mamlechet Kohanim, Goy Kadosh, and all of that. But if you have this disconnect inside of you, it's really hard to do. V'yoved avodat ha'iyun v'aprishut lo kenata kulach yafa ki gam eila chobru yachdav el ha'kodesh. It almost sounds like something out of Rav Kook. In other words, there is this vision of how everything fits together. That's the ideal. The ideal is the totally integrated personality, the integrated existence. In other words, that everything should be of a piece, that everything should fit together. And everything pretty much can fit together as long as human beings don't exercise their free choice to get off the derech. In other words, that animals don't do the wrong thing, and plants don't do the wrong thing, and inanimate creation doesn't do the wrong thing, and all of those things are where they are supposed to be and do what they're supposed to do. Human beings have the choice. I mean, there was this report last week about this guy who was attacked by a grizzly bear twice. And there was that, you know. I mean, well, why were you out there bothering the grizzly bears?
He stopped to Facebook people in the middle before he got help.
Yeah, right. So I mean, you know, okay, he knew what he was doing and he could protect himself, and you know, I mean, he could have died, but. Okay, some people push the envelope and they want to be adventurous and they want to, you know, do those kinds of things. But that's not intrinsic to us. It's not necessary for us.
Yeah, but what happens is people think, they rationalize.
Okay. But I think they also get bored. They also get bored. One of my professors said, "Why do you notice that the people who are race car drivers and alpine climbers are all usually from these countries like Austria or New Zealand, just like boring places? You know, like they're looking to... They're looking to break out and to. I was talking once. It was a lab picnic when my wife was in graduate school. I was talking to this guy from New Zealand. It sounds idyllic. He says, "You know, there are no locks on any doors. It's all beautiful. Everything is paid for. You go to college for free. Healthcare is free. Everything is free. And there's a tremendous brain drain. People leave. And why do people leave? Because it's boring. I mean, you know, people want to." Be challenged. That just seems to be part of nature. And challenge, you challenge authority and you challenge limits and you challenge all kinds of things. You want to see how far you can get. And so, anyway, so the Malbim has this, I think, beautiful image that just like when you see a person who is very attractive, it seems like everything is put together. Of course, it could only be on the surface, back on the sleeve part business, but assuming that it's all. I mean, if you saw in Conversations, I wrote about being shalem and aspiring to that, and Yaakov being shalem in every respect. So to have a vision that everything can fit together, not only a person, but everything in existence, that's quite beautiful. And you have this, if you see in the first of the references in the Torah Tmima, Kula Yafa Rayati, Ze Yaakov Avinu. Shaitami Tato Shlema, Avalonim Tzabab Sol. So, they focus on the fact that as opposed to Avraham, who had one kid who went off, and Yitzchak, who had one kid who went off, Yaakov did not. They weren't all such great tzaddikim, but nobody was like Yishmael or Esav. In other words, that they stayed in the parsha. And so that's a big deal. I mean, all of us, you know, can take it both ways. The people who are lucky enough to have that experience feel...
He didn't have a particularly peaceful life.
No. Bikesh Yaakov Leshe B'Shalva. That's that thing again. In other words, not looking for peace, but to feel that, you know, if things go on, that's a big virtue. Of course, you have no control over that. I mean, there was this great line I was reading of Eva Zornberg on Shabbos. You know, she has one book called Murmuring Deep, which is about inside feelings that people have, which I think is just very interesting. Anyway, so she writes about the fact that Chava, it comes to her that her kids are not going to be exactly the way she wants them to be. She was very, first of all, Hevel gets killed. And Cain, I mean, I always think about this. How does a parent do when a kid does something really awful? I mean, it's your kid. It's not your fault, per se, but it's your kid. So Chava has this experience, and also God has this experience. Human beings don't end up the way he would like them to end up. And so there's this whole thing about you have to come to grips with the fact that even though you perpetuate yourself, it's not necessarily going to be the way you want it to be. That's hard to accept. It's hard to swallow. It's not a simple issue at all. But it's so universal that it even applies to God. I thought that was pretty cool. Chiddush. And so, do you embrace that or don't you? Anyway, let's go to chapter 5. And so in chapter 5, so the two verses that I picked, and I picked one verse in chapter 6 because I knew that we had to sort of move along. So in chapter 5, the two verses are the 2nd and the 11th. Ani yishena velibi er. I'm asleep, but my heart is awake. Some people have insomnia and they're not asleep either. They just can't sleep at all. Kolo dodi dofek. The voice or the sound of my beloved is knocking. Pitchi li achoti rayati yonati tamati. Open the door for me. Shiroshi nimlatal. I'm soaking out here. It's, damp. There's dew all over the place. Ukvutzotai resisei laila. There's rain at night and I'm getting drenched. And, I want to look at that one pasuk, but it's a little story here. Pashati et katonti. She says, oh, wait, I got undressed. I just took a shower. I can't. I'm going to get all dirty again. Dodi shalach yado min achor. May I humu alav. Well, he tried to open the door himself, and my heart went out to him. Kamti ani liftoch dodi. I finally got up to open the door. V'yadi natfun more v'etzbotai more over al kaput hamanul, and there was sort of like the fragrance left of him on the door, on the doorknob. Patachti ani l'dodi v'dodi chamakovar, and he was gone. Nafshi yatsa b'dabro b'kashtiu v'lo matzatiu. I looked for him, I couldn't find him. Krati v'lo anani. There you have life. It's opportunities and sometimes missed opportunities. You hesitate. It's annoying. It's too much. And when you finally get your act together, it's too late. And so this is such an interesting mashal. It's not only in matters of romance, it's all sorts of things. We come to Parshat Drachim, we come to a certain kind of crossroads. Frost says, take the road less traveled. But whatever. And we make decisions. And only in retrospect do we have any idea whether, and even then we don't know for sure, whether we made the right decision. So here is this person who is, seeking, who wants to finally be reunited, but was a little slow coming, getting to that, and it was too late. You have this, the metaphor, which I think is really amazing, is in Franz Kafka's novel, The Castle. His novels don't have endings.
No.
And so The Castle is all about this guy who's looking for the head of the castle, and he can't find him. And sometimes he's too sleepy to understand the instructions. And some people say it's a mashal for him looking for God or a mashal looking for his father. But meanwhile, sometimes you can spend your whole life seeking something and not ever getting it or not ever finding it. So there's a certain tragedy in that, but also the fact that we keep on trucking. We keep on trying to make that connection. So you look at Rashi at the bottom of page 14. Ani yeshana kishayiti shalvav shaketet bebayit rishon. He makes this about the Beit Hamikdash again. When everything was fine in the first temple, no ashti me'avor hakadosh baruch hu kishiyeshana v'nirdam. I had yeush. I didn't think that it was so important for me to go seek out God. I thought everything was cool. Everything is going to stay the same. Nothing will ever change. I'll just do my thing, and I don't have to work very hard. V'libi er, zeh HaKadosh Baruch Hu, kach nidrash bepsikta. God was awake and I was asleep. He wanted me to do heavy lifting and I wasn't ready to do it. V'libi er, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, shehutzur levavi v'chelki. This is the heart, this is the rock of my heart and my portion. Ad l'shamreini leitivli. He wants to do good for me, but I have to be awake. I have to be engaged. Kol dodi dofik, mashresh chinato al neviim. an interesting way to look at it. What's the knock on the door? All the prophets trying to wake me up. In the kol shofar, trying to wake you up. Umazhir al yideihem, hashkeim. Right? Get up. Wake up already. Shaloach. Go out. Pitchili, al tirgamu li shestalek me'ala. Don't cause me to leave. If there's indifference, I'm not going to stick around. You have a certain number of chances. And if you don't take advantage of those chances, then I'm not going to be here anymore. Well, this already, the Rav, in his book, Kol Dodi Dofek, which the English translation is Fate and Destiny, because that's the distinction, but it was called Kol Dodi Dofek. He says that there were six knocks as far as the land of Israel was concerned. Right? The first, the knock of opportunity, was heard in the political arena. No one can deny from that standpoint of international relations, the established state of Israel in a political sense was an almost supernatural occurrence. The fact that the UN voted for it, Rav Nachum Kasher wrote a big fat book called Kol HaTor, The Voice of the Turtle Dove, which was in response to the Satmar Rav, who said how it was a temptation of Satan. That's how anti-Zionist he was. Second, the knocking of the beloved could be heard on the battlefield. The small Israeli defense forces defeated the mighty armies of the Arab countries. That wasn't supposed to happen. Third, the beloved began to knock as well on the door of the theological tent, and it may very well be that this is the strongest knock of all. All the claims of Christian theologians that God deprived the Jewish people of its rights in the land of Israel, and that all the biblical promises regarding Zion and Jerusalem referred in an allegorical sense to Christianity and the Christian church. All of a sudden, the Jews are doing well. So that puts to, you know, that refutes these polemical claims. Fourth, the beloved is knocking in the hearts of the perplexed and assimilated youths. Although today young people, millennials, seem to be opposed to Israel. But at least when this was written in the 1950s, they weren't. Five, the fifth knock of the beloved is perhaps the most important of all. For the first time in history of our exile, divine providence has surprised our enemies with the sensational discovery that Jewish blood is not free for the taking, is not hefker. You can't just get away with it. Of course, that's still an issue today.
Sure.
But meanwhile, there are consequences for doing nasty things. And the sixth knock, which we must not ignore, was heard when the gates of the land were opened. The Jew who flees from a hostile country now knows that he can find a secure refuge in the land of his ancestors. Mm-hmm. So, but the Rav is saying, okay, you got these knocks.
What year was that written?
I believe in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see.
That would make sense.
1956. Yom HaTzmut, 1956, the Rav delivered a public address at Yeshiva University entitled Kol Dodi Dofek.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so the point is that, but what happens when you don't respond to the knock? And what does it mean to respond to the knock? Does it mean give to UJA? Does it mean to go on Aliyah? Does it mean to support Israel in some tangible way? You know, and the implication is, well, if you're too tired, or if you're not ready to get out of bed, who says you'll continue to have that opportunity?
You can't be too tired when you're supporting Israel and the Jewish people.
But what does supporting mean? In other words,
anti-Semitism.
Well, that's one interpretation, but maybe not the only one, and not the correct one. In other words, that's the worry that you have to have as to.
It's also the idea that you know what you would miss afterwards, like you almost. Once it's missed, then you realize what you should have done.
Well, that always happens, right? So that's always a problem. Anyway, so that's a distinctly Zionist twist on this. But you have other things also. Beit HaMikdash, in other words, taking for granted. That's nothing's going to change. It's always going to be there. Don't worry about it. No, not true. The Malbim has his approach to this. We'll read a little bit of the Malbim. So, looking on page 15, Hashir HaRevi, Haraya HaShamayimit Nefesh Shlomo Shachacha Et Dodah Elyon Yamim Rabim. So Shlomo just sort of like, okay, I haven't had Nevuah for a long time. I'm not going to think about God, really. I mean, I don't expect him to come, you know, communicate with me. Kamo Shekatuv, Va'amela Shlomo Ohav Nashim Nachriyot Rabot. That's his substitute. Got involved with this worldly love. Yatu Nashavet Levavo, and these women turned his heart. This whole discussion whether Shlomo himself became an Oved Avodah Zarah, or he looked away and allowed his wives to, or did they actually convert? I mean, the whole business. So God shows up one day and Shlomo's not interested or less enthused than he once was. And God gets insulted. That's this fourth vision or this fourth revelation. God is annoyed. I appear to you, and now you're not interested. Well, because you didn't keep the mitzvot the way I wanted, karoa ekra hamamlacha alecha. Remember the same language with Shaul. I'm going to rip the malchut from you. V'yaz hitarer Shlomo lashu b'tshuva. And Shlomo said, maybe I better repent. Aval lo zacha me'az l'marot Hashem. But God didn't come to him anymore. V'lo yachla nafsho litpashet min achomer. And he wasn't able to do those little journeys where he would separate, where his soul would separate from his body. Ad im moto, until finally when he dies. That's pretty sad. There's this whole tradition in Kohelet and the Gemara's Gittin and Daf Samach or so talks about it that Shlomo was curious and he was dealing with Shadim and the Shade came and took away his Malchut. And that's why it says in Kohelet, Melech Hayiti al Yerushalayim. Once upon a time I was the king, but for at least a while I was deposed. Until they figured it out. So in that sense, you know, Shlomo actually lost everything because he was not prepared. He was curious. He was bored. He didn't want things as they always would be. He wanted things to be different.
He was distracted.
Okay, well, don't we all do that?
That's our generation.
And I okay, in the middle paragraph, on the third line, I underline the b'chol zot liba er ki lo nifrada me'elokea behechleit. So Malbim, as opposed to Rashi, who said that it's God who's awake and the person is asleep, he says, no. God, his soul is awake. He just, not absolutely. There's this quiet hum in the background. You know, it's there, it's resonant, the pintle yid, if you like, you know, that thing. So it reminded me of Leonard Cohen's latest song, which you can find it online. It's called You Like It Darker, which is a... And people say that, you know, it's very much like Kaddish, and it has chazanis in it, and it has a choir from Shar Shamayim, and... But I had a debate with a guy who's a friend of my son's, who's in Montreal... with regard, he said, you know, this shows how he really doesn't get religion and whatever. And I said, oh no, it shows that he does get religion, but he has the problem of theodicy.
What are the lyrics?
The lyrics are that you know, where were you when they were shooting people and they were doing various things to people? So at the one hand, as you get older, you start worrying, this is Pascal's wager, you start worrying, is there a God? Isn't there a God? I better say it gadal v'it gadash. But I still have these reservations. And so someone wrote how Leonard Cohen was not a heretic, he was just a sinner. In other words, that it's not that he stopped believing in God. He was still, he grew up in an Orthodox home, as many of these people do, but he had his issues. And he was an artist, and he went off and did his thing, and he was into Buddhism, and he was into this. And he's a very complex, very interesting person. But you should, you should look at... see if you can listen to his song, and
like
see and yes, and see what you think of it. It's on. He released it on the internet. It was in his 82nd or 83rd birthday, and people don't expect him to tour anymore. And he's done.
But New Yorker?
Yes, there was an interview with the New Yorker, right, where David Remnick went to interview him, which is interesting. I thought I brought it along, but I guess I didn't. I had a note here that I should print it out, but I don't see it. No. I don't have it. Okay, anyway, you can look for it and see what you think. Okay, so that's that pasuk, and then let's finish off with the next pasuk. Oh, so I see I'm not getting to Vav, but okay. Well, maybe we'll do it quickly. So in Perik Hay, looking at verse 11, I noted that there are similarities between these psukim, so chapter 5, verses 11 through 16, where you have a very physical description of the male lover, right? So Rosho Ketem Pazuk Fuzatav Tatalim Shacharot Ka'orev. I mean, that it's like golden, and his hair is very black. Einav Kayonim Alafi Kemayim, etc. If like Rabbi Akiva is correct that this is talking about God and Bnei Israel, then this seems to go very far in anthropomorphizing God. In other words, it gives him these images. Art Green, who wrote a famous book on Rav Nachman of Breslev and was the rector of the Hebrew College in Boston, he's a Reconstructionist, kind of a big scholar. I have an article in Judaism that he wrote that there was a midrash with regard to Yamsuf, where when it says Zekhi Livyamveyu, they pointed, what did they see? They saw a young man who had taken care of them when they were born. There's this whole tradition that the women gave birth without the midwives, and then some kind of figure came and the babies were absorbed into the earth and this figure took care of them. And that's how they recognized him at Yamsuf. And that the rabbi suppressed that midrash because it was too Christological. So here also, when you have God described in these very human terms, these very tangible terms, you could see, so, I mean, one problem with Shir HaShirim are the sexual references, but then a second problem with Shir HaShirim is this very physical depiction. Is God supposed to have, and this voluptuousness, in other words, it's not simply describing God, Selam Elokim, okay, like man, but No, it's giving great detail with regard to how this appears. And it struck me that there are parallels in Anim Zmiro,
yeah.
Right? And there are places that won't sing Anim Zmiro,
right?
Because they feel it's too kadosh. It's too mystical. But it's not mystical based on the Zohar as much as taken from Shir HaShirim. So that's a whole parsha in its own right. In other words, should I be referring to God in this way? So on the one hand, you say, oh, people are using popular nigunim in order to make tefillah relevant. People are using popular imaging to make God relevant. And you could argue that that's the whole point of Christianity, trying to make God tangible. It's not simply like the Greeks and the Romans who took people and gave them superpowers, but rather it's making God attractive that people can relate.
So why was this published?
Why was what published?
Like
Shir HaShirim?
Yeah.
Because it's not clear that that's what it means. In other words, if it was absolutely clear, this is God, and let's describe him this way, I think that would have been a tipping point. I think that would have gotten it, sent to the... Right. But it's whatever you want to make of it. So if you, push it very far. So let's, for instance, look at the Malbim. So it's towards the bottom of page 16. Rosho ata tatchil taro bepratut. We're going to describe his head in detail. Rosho rotulamar mahut machshavato hane'elemet. The nature of his hidden thoughts. Varatzon ha'elyon. And the upper desires. Kamo shehu b'mekoro terem hitgaleh. What is God's thinking before he reveals them, before he communicates with man? What are those thoughts like? Hu davar ne'elam. Well, nobody knows. Stima, dechol stimin. It is the hidden of the hiddens. V'lo yusag mimenu umah. We can't even imagine. V'tara zeh keketem paz, like this fine gold. Haketem hu asot maksheh. It is this filigree, this very delicate kind of metalwork. Sheze moresh epnimuto satum v'chatum. That it shows that there's something beyond that is mystical, mysterious. Yidume ki ein bepnimiotav davar. it even might appear to you as if there is nothing behind it. And it's extremely valuable. Rasul Amar, Davar Yakar Ma'od Hasatum Vane'elam B'Tachlit Ha'alama. The most valuable things are the things that are the rarest and the most difficult to understand and the most remote from us. So that's all very interesting. And so you see, he's not into anthropomorphism at all. He's talking about having a concept of what God's thinking or ideas are like. And so we don't have to put a face or an image to any of this. Or look at what the Torah Tmima has, about four lines from the bottom. Rosho Ketem Paz, Rosho Zua Torah. His head is the Torah. Shnei Amar, Hashem Kaneni Reshit Darko. So here they're using these kinds of analogies with language. Ketem Paz, Elu Divrei Torah. It's not God's thoughts, it's the words of Torah that are this precious gold. Shnei Amar, Hanechmadim Mizahav Mipaz Ravid. They're more precious than even this kind of gold. Kvutzotav Taltalim Afilu Dvarim Shata Roeotan Shein Kotsim B'Torah. Even things that you see, that they are written in black letters in the Torah, Tali Talinheim, there are bundles and bundles that are associated with them. Tili Tili Shel Halachot. So in other words, people like Rabbi Akiva could interpret not only every letter, but even every extra line and every crown on every letter. So what we're saying is, so the hair is like the things that come out of the head. So the head is one thing, but then there are all these zillion hairs, and each hair represents a way of interpreting or understanding the ideas. So that's really way out there. In other words, that's like looking. But you can do that with these psukim. I mean, that's the whole point, that we're dealing with poetry here. And then finally, in chapter 6, verse 3, this is a very famous pasuk, obviously. Anilu dodi v'dodi li haroe b'shoshanim. Right, I am my beloved's. My beloved is mine. They've Rashi Tevot Elul, right? Aleph Lamed Vav Lamed, and people have rings with this, and T-shirts, and all kinds of stuff, right? So Rashi writes, Haroeh Bashoshanim Haroeh Sono B'Mereh Noach Tov. Okay, so he's taking it literally. He doesn't bring his flock to the plain old, you know, pasture. He goes looking where there are wildflowers. Why are there beautiful flowers, which I guess the animals appreciate? The Malbim says, "Ani ata mitchaberet im dodah elyon." So now he's connecting with the beloved one above. Shazem mitat neshika. So already in chapter 6, this is where he dies. V'amra ani lo dodi ki hi asher mitchila matchelet ata b'divuk b'zer barov tshukata el elokim. So finally, his great desire to be with God is realized when he finally leaves his body. And the shepherd, the ethereal shepherd, brings roses. So there's this sort of wedding, this reuniting, by get flowers. I mean, it's just, you know, very pretty. Vihi omeret anilo dodili, etc. Just want to finish with, I mentioned, I guess, last time or the time before, that there are a number of psukim where it talks about this oath that was imposed upon, the Jewish people, right? And so in chapter 5, there's another one of these verses. If you look on page 14, I bolded it. Chapter 5, verse 8, Hishbati etchem benot yushlaim intimsuet odim atagidu, etc. So I think this is the third, and so there are these, you know, this number of shvuot, of oaths. And I told you the Gemara in Ketubot interprets the oaths as having to do with enjoining the Jewish people not to to powerfully invade Israel, but on the other hand, everyone else is supposed to mind their P's and Q's and not, you know. So there's been an exchange in the Jewish Review of Books between Rabbi Sachs and Rabbi Riskin about Rabbi Sachs's book in terms of, he wrote a book about why is it that religious people are associated with terrorism and stuff like that. And he made the argument that Judaism is not terribly interested in power. Whereas that power is a political thing, and therefore religion shouldn't be involved. And as soon as religion and power are connected, it's a very volatile mix, and it, you know, is inappropriate. Right? Riskin responds and says, power is part of the religion. And he writes, this is one of the things that he writes, according to the famous three oaths of the Talmud, God admonished the people of Israel not to climb the ramparts to Jerusalem to secure Jewish independence, not to rebel against the nations of the world, and in turn admonished the nations not to subjugate us too harshly. Auschwitz made a mockery of this. If any light emerged, it was a hope for a Jewish homeland after 2,000 years of homelessness, a summons for a Jewish state after 2,000 years of statelessness, a desperate desire for an Israeli defense force after 2,000 years of defenselessness, in short, a call for Jewish power after 2,000 years of powerlessness. And remember, Rabbi Riskin lives in Israel, and Rabbi Sacks does not. So there's going to be a different attitude, it seems to me, for people who are on the line. I mean, not trying to suggest that Rabbi Sacks is not sensitive to the security needs of the state of Israel, but when you live it day to day and your kids go into the army and you officiate at funerals of people and et cetera, you're going to have a different outlook.
Also, Rabbi Sacks, and we live in a time where it's not as bad for Jews in countries as it was.
Well, you can argue. I mean, he lives in Europe and he has...
No, I mean, but compared to the correct pogroms and the Holocaust...
Okay, but it could get bad.
It could.
And so... So there's an interesting, you know, exchange. It was Rabbi Riskin's original review of Rabbi Sacks' book where he was critical of some of it. Rabbi Sacks wrote a response, and Rabbi Riskin writes a response to the response. It's an issue. So it shows that the stuff that's based in Tanakh, which the Gemara interpreted, is a very fundamental, it's a lot. In other words, that people invoke this stuff because it speaks to the human condition or the or current events. It's not something that's just theoretical or irrelevant.
So I always find it hard to understand, like the Rav or like Feinstein, yeah, people like that who didn't push on.
Well, the Rav was in line to be Rav Roshi, and he went and he interviewed and he lost. So many people say that was the reason why, you know, on a personal level. I mean, the argument that you can make for the Lubavitch Rebbe and other people is that if you're involved in Jewish service, so therefore you have to find the context where you can do it the best.
Lubavitch Rebbe, maybe he himself personally, but he does have a lot of people who...
So the Rav does too. I mean, there are many people who feel... Look at the Rav's son-in-law, Rav Lichtenstein. The Rav was not happy about his grandchildren disappearing and whatever, but, you know, his daughter and son-in-law felt that that was a value. So, I mean, some of it is personal, but I think from the point of view of doing something worthwhile, it's harder for me to justify someone who is not serving the Jewish community and choosing to be in Chutz Lars.
I mean, in terms of, you know, the leadership saying,
yeah,
you know,
well,
that time.
I think it's hard for a person who himself, I mean, it's hypocritical. When a person himself is not doing something, you know, do as I say and not as I do, I think that's difficult. So to expect someone who has not made that choice to encourage people to make that choice smacks a bit of hypocrisy.
But Koldo di Dofake,
he's talking about responding, but like we had this debate here, what does responding mean? In other words, to be indifferent would be wrong, but how far do you have to go? And obviously there are going to be different interpretations of that. To just ignore everything that's going on, or as Riskin always says, to use Israel as Disneyland. In other words, that it's a great place to visit and to have vacations, but it's not something that you personally undertake and participate in. But again, he made that choice too. If he hadn't made that choice, so I mean, it's a chicken and egg kind of problem.
That's
in other words, well, that's true. But maybe the American Jewish community would be different. Who knows? I mean, you can't sort of second guess these things. Things will take their. And when a person chooses, it's, you know, if a person was alone, okay, then you can choose. But you have children, you have a family, you have relatives to pick up and go. I mean, remember my son said that the biggest factor against Aliyah is the cost of coming back and visiting people in Chutz La'aretz. So if you don't have enough money to be able to do that, then will you necessarily, you know, break the connection?
But years ago, when people were, I know my family moved from Russia, and they trucked across Europe, and they made it here. They didn't have a telephone. They didn't go back. You wrote letters, and that's as far as it went.
Well, I think Russia was a different situation where essentially a Jew decided that he couldn't stay there. So when people couldn't stay somewhere, so then they have to go relocate with all of the challenges and problems that that involves. The question is, where do you relocate? You know, and there are people who had the chance to go to Israel and went elsewhere, and you know, that's whatever that is. Or people who were in Israel and who left, that's where that is. It's just interesting to think about. I'm not trying to be judgmental. It's after Yom Kippur, I've learned my lesson.
Well, when the Rav wrote his book,
yes,
it was in the 50s.
Yes.
State of Israel was born in 48.
Yes.
Boston area, he took over and he changed the kashrut.
Yes.
He changed the educational system.
Yeah.
He changed the... the whole way of thinking about communities.
Right.
And he was on the outs for a long time.
Of course he was.
But that's
and what would have happened if he had gone to Israel then? That would have been interesting.
It would have been,
interesting for Israel.
A lot of people would have been lost.
But you know what? You have
somebody to follow him.
Yeah.
Remember there was this guy, Essis, who was a big activist in Russia.
So one of his relatives.
Oh, yes?
Yeah.
Anyway, so he left finally, and he came to speak when I was in the Jerusalem Fellows. He came to speak to us, and I asked him, "Don't you ever worry about the people that you left behind?" In other words, there were people who depended upon you, and if you leave them, who says that they'll ever find anyone else? He said, "All my life I dreamed about going to Israel. I had the opportunity, I go." Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to prioritize. Or the or a similar thing to me, we. When I was on the beginning of my road of learning and whatever, so we had a summer occasion with someone, and then I was supposed to be in that person's shir, and things didn't really work out that well between us. But I knew that it would be insulting to him if I would beg off of his shir. So I asked the shaila, and I was told, when it comes to learning, you have to be selfish, that you can't just be polite and then hold yourself back, your development back. So, you know, or when we moved into our apartment in the west, in the east side, the people who lived there before were two shrinks, and they were just leaving and going to Buffalo someplace. And I was thinking to myself, what do the patients do? One day you walk in and say, "Oh, by the way, I'm not going to be here anymore. Wait a second, I have transference and all this kind of stuff. I've done all this stuff with you, and you just..." Leaving?
Well, that's with any.
Yes, it is.
Yes,
it
is.
Yes, it is.
Many times, which I took to heart,
yes.
That nobody's a replacement.
That's correct. That's. I mean, on a certain level, you can't get all hung up on that. But there's going to be some people who have greater super egos than others and who have a great sense of responsibility. But at a certain point in time, you have to make a decision as to, especially if it's having adverse effects on you. In other words, who says, just because everyone else is benefiting, who says that you are? So if a person feels that they need to do this for themselves, I think that it's at least a consideration. You can be self-sacrificial up to a point. And if this is the way that, and plus, if you think it's beneficial for your family and beneficial, I mean, many people feel that even though it's hard for adults, it's wonderful for kids. For kids to grow up in that environment, So then you
I was thinking the same thing. What age?
So, well, that's also part of it.
My cousin made Aliyah last summer. Her daughter was in 11th grade, and it was hard.
Very hard. Very hard.
The younger, the better.
I think we know, every family that moved, we know one, at least one kid who's not from anymore. People went for their children's religion.
Right.
So
but it doesn't.
There's no telling that child would have done in America.
Also correct.
There were three siblings who survived Abby's father's family. One went to America, one went to Israel, one went to England. They all separated.
Mm-hmm.
So the Americans are modern Orthodox. The British are super, black hats. Okay. The Israelis not religious at all.
Okay, there you go. That's also interesting. Anyway.